do it. I didn't inherit it.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here on case 2014-319, State Ex Rel Ohio Civil Service Employees Association et al. Versus State of Ohio. We're going to start with Mr. Murphy.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, State Solicitor Eric Murphy, I will be using all the appellant's 10 minutes, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Plaintiff's three claims in this case, under the one subject rule, under the credit and ownership provisions of Article 8, Section 4, and under the public employer laws, all fail to state a claim as a matter of law. First, their claim under the one subject rule fails because this court long ago said that a new substantive tax could be included in a budget bill because it pays for the operations discussed elsewhere in the bill. This case involves a different way to generate revenue, a prison sale, with the same obvious budgetary connection. To invalidate the prison provisions in this case would only place a thumb on the scale in favor of tax increases over other methods for balancing the state's budget. But those types of policy concerns are for the general assembly, not for the courts under the one subject rule. Second, plaintiff's Article 8, Section 4 claim fails because they have not adequately alleged a lending of credit or joint ownership violation. With respect to lending of credit, they don't even assert that type of claim in their complaint, and so it's waived, and that is for good reason, because that type of claim, the critical facts for that type of claim are not mentioned in their complaint, and that is that the state either lent or gave its borrowing power to a private party. With respect to joint ownership, they don't allege that the state jointly owns anything with any private party. And thirdly, the public employer law claim fails because this court has an unbroken line of precedence holding that those types of claims fall within the exclusive original jurisdiction of CERB, and plaintiffs cannot bypass CERB and proceed directly to the courts. So I'd like to begin with the one subject rule because that is...
I'd like to begin with the third one, if that's okay.
Okay, sure.
If we can talk about the public employee issue, what was alleged in the complaint?
So largely, they sought a declaratory judgment that they were employees within the meaning of the public employer laws, particular 4117.01c that defines public employee, and then they said that they sought the rights and the wage scales of public employees under the relevant collective bargaining agreement.
And I think I understand the issue in terms of whether the Common Pleas Court has jurisdiction or CERB would have jurisdiction. If we assume for the moment that the Common Pleas Court does not have jurisdiction, how is jurisdiction invoked at CERB? How would that be done with these parties?
Well, I think they would assert a claim that that there's an unfair labor practice because they're not abiding by the relevant collective bargaining agreement. So it'd be like Wilkinson when the state closed a prison and they asserted that the closure violated the collective bargaining agreement when they laid off the employees.
And that's
and that. So, and then the defense would be, well, they're not public employees. And then it would be like a line of cases. The CERB would make the determination of whether they are or are not public employees. And then that would be appealable to the courts.
That's the piece of this that seems very odd to me, is that CERB would be making a decision for purposes of PERS, for example, or DAS. And how encompassing would that CERB decision be?
Well, so I think it would only be with respect to the public employer law. So lots of the court's cases suggest if they invoke rights that fall outside the public employer laws, then the courts would have jurisdiction. But I think that's why we do not assert that they don't have jurisdiction over the constitutional claims, because those are rights outside of the collective bargaining process. But with respect, when you're asserting a right directly invoked by the relevant chapter 4117, and here they clearly are because they're saying they're public employees within the meaning of that chapter, that's where you have to go to CERB first. I think with respect to OPERS, there might be other OPERS provisions that will not affect the analysis.
And so you're not suggesting at all that they would be foreclosed from taking other actions to determine whether they're public employees and what benefits they would enjoy just that they, given what they've said in the complaint, it doesn't work here.
I think that's right, because they're relying solely for their public employee status on the chapter 4117, and that relevant provision. And the court has already suggested that, in the Franklin County case, that whether a sheriff or a county was the relevant public employer was a question that should be resolved by CERB first. And that's not saying that the courts don't get involved, it just CERB has exclusive original jurisdiction, which would mean that once CERB makes a determination, then that would be appealable, as in Carter and some of these other cases.
Thank you.
Turning to the one subject rule, I think I'd like to begin by just emphasizing that the plaintiffs and the state could not set forth two more distinct tests for determining whether a provision in a budget bill is related to the primary subject of the budget. But I think the critical fact to emphasize is that only the state's test that a provision be rationally related to or rationally affect the budget reconciles all the court's one subject cases in this area. I think the plaintiff's test would require the court to overrule a whole line of cases. And so I'd like to just start with that and start.
What is the line item that's being challenged in the appropriation?
What's that?
What is the line item in the appropriation bill that's being challenged?
It's the substantive change, the prison sale provision. So that
there's
be
two parts. There's the sale, and then there's a series of payments over a period of 20 years of $3.8 million back to the purchaser. So are both being challenged, or is only the sale being challenged?
So I think we have to set forth which claim we're talking about. With respect to the annual ownership fee, that's not a single
subject.
Well,
we're talking about the
single
subject rule. That's what you introduced for us.
Yeah, and that.
And my question relates to that, because I want to know if you're suggesting the line item on authorization of the sale is part of the appropriation, or whether the payments out of the General Assembly over the next 20 years is the line item being.
So
that's why I'm trying to focus you on that issue.
Yeah, so the payments are just an application. They're not in the statute. The statute just says you can either sell a prison, and it doesn't talk about the means, or well, it has some requirements, but it doesn't talk about that mean. And then it also says you can contract with a third party to operate the prison. And I think that fee is related to the operations side. And that's nothing new. That operations side has actually been in the statute since 1995. And this is part, that fee, I guess, is in turn paying, is essentially what we call is analogous to a lease payment, because since we no longer own the prison, we have
so
to
that,
pay them
a
something
lease
to
payment
use
then is not an appropriation, or is it, in your view?
So it would only be for the two-year biennium, but it would be, yes, it's an appropriation. I completely agree with that. But it's not, I don't think it's mentioned in the bill itself. There's just an appropriation to DRC and out of that appropriation.
So what is the line item that's being challenged here?
The line item would be, it's not an appropriations part, it's not the appropriations part of the bill that's being challenged, it's the substantive changes to the revised code that is being challenged. And it's 9.06J, and then the uncodified portion of the statute, 753.10, that authorizes DRC to sell five prisons. The prison we sold is the Lake.
So it's the line item on privatization.
Well, sale. So privatization and sale, I guess, combined. But the privatization component of that has been in the statute for quite some time.
Thank you.
And so I think this goes to show, this whole discussion goes to show how directly related it is to appropriations, however, because the sale brought in a stream of revenue of the sale. In paragraph one of their complaint, they assert that the sale actually brought in $72 million, and it's just common sense that $72 million will be channeled into the general revenue fund to pay for state operations elsewhere. And this court already said in Comtech that a new substantive tax could be included in an appropriations bill because the tax pays for items that are appropriated. This is the same exact concept, it's just a different way of generating revenue.
Well, your opposing counsel would say that the $72 million being brought in is going to be paid out over the next 20
years.
So
So a couple points with that, Your Honor. So the $72 million comes in for this appropriation cycle, and then the only amount paid out with respect to that lease would be the $3 million for the two-year period, $3.8 million for the 2 years. And then that only that per, that that payment that's going out is only binds one General Assembly, because the General Assembly can't bind the next General Assembly with respect to appropriations. So the next General Assembly can decide whether or not to continue making that payment. But that's the key point. The $72 million came in this budget. When the governor came into office, there was a historic budget deficit. This raised a significant amount of revenue to fix the budget. And so to say that this type of revenue-generating measure cannot be included in a budget bill would really hamper the General Assembly and their ability to balance the budget. And they have this constitutional duty. They have to meet expenditures with revenues.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals didn't answer this question definitively, didn't they? They just said the trial court pulled the trigger too quickly.
Well, I think that's
a procedural posture at this point. I'm wondering what would can you conjure up examples of what would violate the single subject rule in a budget?
Sure, I would
in
think.
In a budget bill. Because the legislature has forever thrown all manner of things in there. Clearly, many of them would violate the single subject rule, but nobody calls them on it.
Well, I think it depends
so,
on.
So when somebody does object, then we have to fight our way through what's a violation and what isn't.
Well, a couple of points, Your Honor. First, I think it depends on what the test is for the single subject rule, of course, and I think the test should be, does it rationally impact the budget? And then you just have to ask that question. And something that's totally unrelated, lots of things are totally unrelated to state operations. When the state is acting as more of a regulator.
Well, operations and budget aren't the same thing, are they?
Well, they largely are, because the budgets pay for the operations. But imagine just a regulation of private parties that has nothing to do with the state. What if they changed the statute of limitations on a contract between private parties in the budget bill? That might have concerns. How would that rationally impact the budget? There obviously is going to be a line drawing problem, but I think that the provisions at issue here fall easily.
But
whatever
it,
the test.
It isn't what happened below in the Court of Appeals is that they said the plaintiff may be able to show a violation. Dismissal was premature.
So I don't think that's correct. That's what they said, but I think that was mistaken for this reason. Under the rational basis test, there's no obligation on the part of the state to present evidence. They remanded for an evidentiary hearing. I have no idea what that would be, because it's just the single subject rule. You look at the bill. Does it have a primary subject? And is this rationally related to that subject? And when making that rational relationship test, under rational basis review, the state, it's black letter law that the state doesn't have to present evidence. The court makes its own independent determination. Can it see a rational connection here? And you can, I frankly think that there's a direct connection here. And so I think there's a couple problems with the 10th district's analysis. It's unclear what the remand was for, because this is a legal question, not a factual question. And number two, more broadly, you mentioned the line by line item approach, and I think that is very problematic with respect to the separation of powers, because the challenge here, we of course do not dispute, these are prior prison employees. They can present a challenge to the prison provisions, but the 10th district analysis opened up the entire bill to a line by line, essentially the trial court going through and striking out which ones the trial court didn't think was related to the
but
subject.
But counsel, let me just ask you one very basic question. Didn't the 10th District Court of Appeals really, in a broad brush, suggest that this bill is changing the way the state of Ohio runs its institution? A substantive change that on day one there are public workers and on day two it's a private contractor. Isn't that a substantive change in the way the state of Ohio is doing its business?
Well, I would agree that this is an appropriation, if there's a distinction between an appropriation and a substantive change, but the court has for decades suggested that substantive changes to operations can be put in budget bills as long as they have an effect on the budget. That was Comtech. That was a substantive change. It was a substantive change to the tax code. It was a tax increase.
Looks like we have some common ground here. You're agreeing it's a substantive change.
So I'm agreeing it's not an appropriation, certainly, under Let Ohio Vote, but I don't think that appropriation only is the test. Appropriation only is the test would require this court to overrule several of its single subject cases, including Comtech, including Dix, where it said appropriations and substantive changes can be brought brought in the same bill, and including AFL-CIO, where there was, again, it was a substantive reorganization of the Bureau of Workers' Compensation matched with an appropriation, and the court had no problem that the appropriation came with it.
And you're suggesting that a sale that generates revenue falls within the appropriation of the budget bill?
Yeah, it's, it has a direct
And that would be
effect.
Your, I mean, if we're talking bright line, you would say that a sale that generates revenue for the state is fairly within the budget bill.
Yeah, the question under our test is, does it irrationally impact the budget? And you don't need to think, under rational basis review, you don't consider evidence, you consider, does a income of $72 million affect the budget? And of course it does.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Malley, or Melly, I'm sorry.
May it please the court, my name is James Melly, and I represent the Appalese Cross Appellants in this case. I want to give you an overview first for a minute, and then I want to address some of the questions that the court posed. First, this is the first time the state of Ohio has ever authorized the sale of a prison. Second, it's the first time the state of Ohio has ever sold a prison. Third, it's the first time any state in this country has ever sold a prison. So you've got a big first here. Secondly, the way they finance this transaction is the first time, I think, across the country that it's been done with what I brought out in the brief about the annual ownership fee, which is referred to as the AOF. It's a financing arrangement. No one has ever found a case on this in all of the research we've done from day one in this case up to here. So you've got major issues. Now I'd like to go to Justice French's question about public employees and CERB's jurisdiction. First and foremost, when the General Assembly passed House Bill 153, they enacted 9.06K. And in that section, they said that the Common Pleas Court in Franklin County has jurisdiction if you are alleging that some action that was taken violates the Constitution. We clearly allege that, there's no doubt about it. Secondly, it said that the Franklin County Common Pleas Court has jurisdiction if there is a violation of any provision in 4117. And we allege that. And we allege that the state defendants have claimed that our employees are private sector employees. So they're not covered by our collective bargaining agreement. They're not considered public employees under Ohio law. They don't work for a public employer, and CERB has no jurisdiction over them. And because they're not being accorded the benefits, the wages, and the rights of public employees, they are violating a revised code statute.
But counsel, if we look at, I think your friends on the other side, you heard Mr. Murphy say, the claim here is really about their collective bargaining rights. And that is something that CERB would traditionally have jurisdiction to decide. Now, I agree with you that there are other issues. There are PERS issues, there might be DAS issues, but those would be outside of CERB, but they would also be outside of the Common Pleas Court.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, I'm sorry. I don't think I've actually asked you a question, but I'm just having trouble getting my head around what did you claim. And does that specific claim out of your complaint belong at CERB?
What they're saying is a rewriting of the facts of this case and a rewriting of 4117C.
But I'm not rewriting the facts of the case. I'm looking at your complaint specifically, and the complaint says we have rights under our collective bargaining agreement. That sounds to me like a claim that belongs in CERB.
We said we have rights under 4117.01C, which says that when the state contracts out state work, that the employees are considered public employees. So our rights are triggered after they're no longer state employees. That is, the state has to make a contract and give the work over to the private sector. Then they have to let us go. Once they let us go, we're not employees, we're not relying on our collective bargaining agreement. As a matter of fact, we can't, because federal law takes over for anything that's in the private sector. And if there's any question about it, there's a preemption. Federal law would preempt everything. So we are not relying upon our bargaining rights under Ohio law. We have no bargaining rights. And as we pointed out in our brief, we cannot even represent the employees at, for example, the Marion prison, because the OCSEA represents what's called rank and file employees and guards, corrections officers. In the federal sector, You can't do that. So we cannot even represent the people at MTC. So that is what they're suggesting, that this is a CERB issue. CERB can't decide anything in this case. They can't decide federal labor law.
Do you think we have to overrule Satula to agree with you?
Your Honor, I forget the facts in Satula.
Well, I remember the holding as being fairly broad, that this court said, I believe it was in 2010, I could have that wrong as well, but that what this court said was, we're going to send all of those issues that relate to collective bargaining to CERB.
Well, that's just it. CERB only has jurisdiction over state contracts. Mm-hmm. We don't have a state contract that applies in this case. We are saying that we want to represent these people, but right now we're precluded from doing it. We can't represent anybody there, and we are not relying upon any collective bargaining agreement.
Counsel, getting back then to why we're here today, it seems to me that what you are suggesting is that the only way what the state is trying to do could be accomplished would be by a single legislative act saying, we're going out of the prison business, we're going to pass a bill, you're no longer public employees. Is that what you're saying?
Can I express it a little bit differently, Your Honor? First of all,
it's your microphone.
Thank you, Your Honor. We've got to look at what are the facts in the bill. And under the bill, yes, they authorized the sale of the prisons. One prison was sold, but there are certain restrictions on the sale proceeds. And that's what we formed our basis on. The state's making an argument that this created a stream of revenue in the appropriations bill, which by itself is a contradiction, because when you put money in a cash register, that's revenue in, but when you make an appropriation, you're taking money out of the cash register.
No, counsel, maybe you misunderstood my question, or maybe I didn't put it properly. I guess what we're here to talk about today is the one subject rule.
Yes.
And it seems to me that what you are suggesting is that when the state of Ohio decides to privatize prisons, fire their employees, and let the prison operators hire private sector workers, that that is a substantive change in the way the state does business, and it does not belong in a budget bill.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we relied upon, and the Court of Appeals relied upon, the Simmons-Harris case. That's the closest precedent to this case, and that was the voucher program that was put forth in a budget bill. And
I'm most intrigued by why the Court of Appeals thinks they can send that back to the trial court and do a line-by-line analysis. That does not make any sense to me.
Well, and the state has argued that, but they've never really actually examined it fully. The Court of Appeals said that the state never gave the court any guidance as to why this was proper in an appropriations bill. And they never explained to the court how it would alter or affect a budget. And they said that the only argument that the state made in the Court of Appeals was that everything's united by appropriations, a position that this court rejected both in Simmons-Harris and also in the OCSEA-1 case that we brought out in our brief.
But I guess the problem I'm having, though, is your answer to Justice French, I don't think, is really getting to the issue. If it is a CERB question, if there are public employees who on day one have a job and on day two no longer have a job, why isn't that a CERB question?
Because our rights are triggered under 41-1701C, which says that when the state makes a contract with the private sector, that we are public employees in the private sector. We are not public employees drawn at that point a state wage or being paid by a state warrant. We are being paid by, in this case, Management and Training Corporation.
Didn't the complaint allege or ask for a declaration that they were public employees under the statute?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so that was the issue, was it not? I mean, that's what we're having difficulty with. Doesn't the determination of whether they are public employees belong to CERB?
No, Your Honor. 9.06K says, if we have alleged that there is a violation of 4117, that the jurisdiction, or I'm sorry, if we have alleged that there is a violation of any provision of the revised code, which 4117 is, that the Common Police Court of Franklin County has jurisdiction over that issue. We have alleged that they have failed to apply 4117.01c, making us a public employee, and therefore the court has jurisdiction. This is a statutory question as well as the Franklin County law enforcement case. First of all, and we argued this in our brief, first of all, the statute controls and says that the Common Police Court has jurisdiction. Secondly, and I think everybody overlooks this all the time, yes, we're all aware of the Franklin County Law Enforcement Association case. I was counsel in that case, and this court said that there's two ways CERB gets jurisdiction. One, if somebody files something with jurisdiction. That didn't happen here. The second way that this court said that CERB gets jurisdiction is if the complaint in the Common Pleas Court alleges something over which CERB has jurisdiction, such as a petition for certification election, a petition for representation election, and unfair labor practice.
Counsel, was there a collective bargaining agreement in place when this prison was sold?
Yes, there was.
All right, and that had life left to it?
It did, but the minute it was sold, it didn't.
Okay, that's, I think, maybe a focus here that is, and that should be your complaint, that that collective bargaining agreement should have been continued even in the face of the sale?
No. We're saying that somebody has to declare that we're public employees. Everybody.
But the only one that can declare public employees is CERB, isn't it?
CERB is, again, Your Honor, the...
You're looking at 906 for a violation of a statute as... as your entree for jurisdiction in the Franklin County Common Pleas Court. But I think what's troubling some of the members of our court is that the statute that you're alleging in 4117 as a declaration of who our public employees belongs to CERB, and you haven't really addressed that.
I would respond back to the court, and I don't mean this the way it's going to come out, but under what authority does CERB have jurisdiction? There is no statutory authority putting this question in front of CERB. And we have tried to make this point in our briefs. CERB, this court has said that an administrative agency only has jurisdiction when a statute gives it to them. And the court can't create jurisdiction out of thin air. And so where is the statute that vests jurisdiction in CERB to determine that our rights as private sector employees over here our public employees.
And I understand your argument on that, and I see you're running out of time. Did you want to address the single subject issue?
Your Honor, I would like to bring out, thank you for that. First, that there was no, in addition to the fact that they put a substantive program in and it's covered by Simmons-Harris, there is no stream of revenue even produced by this because of the restrictions that the General Assembly put on the sale of the prison proceeds. When the sale was made and the state got the $72 million, they had to put it into account and segregate that money from the general revenue fund. And it could not have been used to balance anything, any budget in the general revenue fund because they had to satisfy the conditions. And the statute at that time said, no money shall be transferred out of here unless you show from that bond counsel has written an opinion saying that the people that hold bonds, state bonds, and get interest payments are not harmed by that. In other words, their interest payments are still tax-free.
So are you suggesting that this General Assembly has bound another General Assembly with those funds?
They later on repealed that statute, Your Honor, but we evaluate the single subject rule by the four corners of the legislation
Thank you.
Itself.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Abrams.
Chief Justice, members of the court, I'm Jim Abrams from Taft, Stennis, and Hollister, representing Corrections Corporation of America and CCA Western Properties, Inc. Our interest in this case today revolves around cross-appellants, two propositions of law that affect my client. First, the question of whether or not the Constitution, Article 8, Section 4, is offended by the state entering into a contract to sell a prison to a private entity. And then, of course, the question of whether or not Revised Code Chapter 4117 serves with exclusive original jurisdiction to determine what was requested in the cross-appellant's complaint.
Mr. Abrams, I wonder if you could begin with Mr. Melly's point that 9.06K is what gives the Franklin County Common Pleas Court jurisdiction over this, over the public employee question.
Your Honor. I don't believe that it does, because I think there's established case law that including the Franklin County Employers Association, Enforcement Association versus FOP case, that establishes that anything that arises out of 4117 is within the exclusive jurisdiction of CERBS, and that CERBS has in fact the ultimate right initially to make a determination of whether or not issues related to collective bargaining apply to various employees.
But is this a collective bargaining issue or a constitutional violation allegation and a failure to apply 4117, which is what I think Mr. Melly argued?
Your Honor, I think if you look at the cross-appellant's complaint in paragraph 168, they allege that they are seeking the declaration for the purposes of determining whether or not their employees are entitled to collective bargaining. So I think it falls four square within that provision. And I think it also falls within Ohio's Historical Society versus CERBS in terms of determining who's a public employee.
But counsel, I guess that's where I'm having a problem conceptually understanding the one subject rule here. It seems like everybody is in agreement. On day one, they're public sector workers guarding the prison. And on day two, they work for a private corporation, and the state has washed its hands of that matter.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not here to address one subject. I defer to the state on that. But I will say this about Section 906. There is nothing new here with respect to private operators of prisons. I believe that the operation and management of prisons has been vested in private contractors since 1995. So that's not new. The only unique feature here is that House Bill 153 permitted the state to monetize an asset. Corrections Corporation paid $72.8 million to purchase an asset. And with those monies, then the state entered into a contract with CCA for the purpose of paying for the ownership risk and the exclusive use of the facility.
But if you look at the one subject rule, therefore, could the state of Ohio tomorrow say that we're going to privatize Shawnee State Park and give it to someone other than the Department of Natural Resources to manage, and we'll just put that in the budget bill and everybody will be happy?
Again, Your Honor, I would defer to the state on the one subject rule issue, but I would say that it strikes me that any matter that might help monetize assets for the state in order to offset operating costs in the state are budgetary.
So that if the state of Ohio decided tomorrow Pinkertons should replace the Ohio State Highway Patrol, that would not violate the one subject rule in a budget, since it's revenue enhancing, obviously.
It would depend on how that transaction was structured, I think, Your Honor. I think here what we're talking about is monetizing an asset.
Well,
in both of your examples, the Shawnee State example and, of course, in the Corrections Corporation case, we purchased and delivered $72.8 million to the state of Ohio.
Is it correct that this is the first time for the sale of a state asset and lease back?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is it correct that this was the first time for the state of Ohio to sell a property and lease it back at the same time?
I don't think it's the first time the state of Ohio has ever sold a property to a private entity, I don't know whether or not there's ever been a transaction where the state has decided to sell, for example, the Rife Center and lease it back. I don't know that. But I will tell you that in this case, it is the first time that a prison was sold in the state of Ohio. I agree with Mr. Mellion there.
Could you comment on the statement that there is no stream of revenue here?
Apparently, the argument that the cross appellants are making in that regard, as it relates to this one subject rule, is that the state had to put funds in a separate fund, and therefore the money wasn't used to defer operating costs. I think that's their argument. I frankly would again defer to the state in that regard. If there are no further questions, I would respectfully request that I yield my rest of my time to Eric Murphy. Thank you.
That's good, because he used all of his time for rebuttal the first time around. Mr. Murphy, come up and take advantage of 3 minutes.
Just a couple of quick comments. On the first time, it is true that's the first time the state has sold a prison, but it's not the first time a government entity has sold something big. The court has a decision from 1896 called City of Cincinnati versus Dexter, where the city sold a railroad, so I don't think it's unprecedented. Number two, with respect to 9.06K, I would analogize it to a venue provision. In fact, it's very similar to the venue provision that this court discussed in Jobs, Ohio. In Jobs, Ohio, the argument was that venue provision created standing. The court rejected it and said no, for claims that are properly in court, it shows which court of common pleas should be, where it should be. It's a venue provision, where the suit should be brought. This is the same exact idea. We have no dispute that the constitutional claims, the one subject claims, are properly within court. It's just the claim related to the public employer status and related to the collective bargaining agreement that belongs to CERB. With respect to Simmons-Harris, I think the key point of Simmons-Harris is the last portion of the opinion where it says we're not overruling Dix, we're just clarifying Dix. It said, in particular, we're not saying Dix stands for the proposition that a state can create a new substantive program and immunize it from one subject status simply because it's tied to an appropriation. We're not saying
that.
What
is the test you're advocating, Mr. Murphy, that we apply to determine whether we determine this to be a single subject or not?
What is the test?
Yeah, what guide should
does it have? Does it have an irrational effect on the state budget?
And where are you getting that from?
From the court's cases. With respect to the...
Which case are you relying
on? So it's several cases. So on the budget, it's with respect to the subject, what should the subject be for this bill? It's Comtech.
And what?
Comtech, the case that added, that said a substantive tax could be in a budget bill. The court said defined the subject in Comtech as dealing with the state operations. So that's a pretty broad subject. Later cases from the lower court, City of Riverside, have said the core of a budget bill are appropriations and revenues. With respect to the rational basis test, that's Dix and Beagle. Dix was a case that involved the Department of Development, a reorganization of the Department of Development. With that reorganization came a new appropriation, and they challenged putting both appropriations and substantive changes in the law. And the court said, no, the test should be under... It's the first case where the court actually said we're going to get back into the one-subject arena. And the court said we're going to apply a very deferential test. The test is analogous to the rational basis test, and as long as you have a rational or legitimate reason for including it in the subject. So I put those two together, rational effect on the state budget, and that's the test,
thank
and
you.
I think it's obvious.
Thank you.
What about stream of revenue that was raised by Mr. Mellon?
So that was the last point I was going to make. So 2 points on that. I think it's factually inaccurate and irrelevant. Factually inaccurate because the statute said, of course, it had to go, the statute is referring to is before you could place these funds into the general revenue fund, you had to assure that the bonds were defeased, whatever that language means. But eventually, the bonds did get to the general revenue fund. I would admit that that's outside the record because when he filed the complaint, they were still in that Dawe Juvenile Correction Bond Fund. But that's irrelevant because under the rational basis test, you don't ask, was the program successful? You just ask, is there a rational basis between the two things? Here, it was generating revenue that obviously is just like a tax in terms of whether it belongs in a budget bill. I would posit that even if the tax discussed in Comtech generated no revenue, it would not have been a single subject violation. So that's
Thank
why
you.
I say it's irrelevant. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision.